Welcome to Zero Downtime, the new podcast brought to you by DCD's editorial team in partnership with Vertiv, the world's leading critical infrastructure provider.
Vertiv has kept the world's leading businesses connected for more than 50 years. We build, deliver, and support critical infrastructure that's available, sustainable, and future-ready. Visit us at Vertiv.com and see what we can do for you.
Hello, welcome to DCD Downtime. This week, we're talking with Chris Monroe, Chief Scientist at IonQ, one of the more interesting quantum startups there are around, quantum computing startups, I should say. And I should also check first that I pronounced your company name right.
Hi, Peter. Great to be here. It is IonQ indeed. IonQ, it's based on ions, atomic ions, charged atoms that we use as our quantum transistor, if you will.
Right. And so it's a rare instance in the computing industry if something does what it says on the tin, really. The Q kind of denotes quantum, and ions is because other people are using different approaches instead of trapped ions.
Yeah, you know, the concept of a computer, at least the way we understand it, it's independent of the hardware. You know, you don't need to know or care what's inside of the machine as long as it does the math you want, as long as it does your application. So in these early days of quantum computing, indeed, there are a few different platforms, physical platforms, to do the computations. It's a pretty exotic form of computing, and we're in the early days, so it's very exciting.
Yeah, I mean, and how exotic is it really? Is it starting to become closer to reality here, or even actually real? I mean, it can't be that exotic, as there seem to be dozens of different companies doing it. And,
where do I start? It's indeed real. It's indeed real right now, but it is still exotic. And even as it gets more real, we're going to see more amazing things. And what's exotic about it is that the laws of computing are based on physics that people are not familiar with. There's no analogies in everyday life. I mean, even regular computing, the bits, the zeros and ones, the way they're processed, there's always something, some physical process underneath it that, like electrons moving from point A to point B, very much like a football travels. You know, we have that analogy.
Regular semiconductors do indeed need tunneling and other quantum phenomena. So yes, but a quantum computer is kind of a different level to that.
Yeah, what you said is true about semiconductors. However, you can teach it to a third grader in terms of, I remember learning about transistors. There's a picture, Transistor Man, and he basically is told to turn on a valve or turn off a valve. And he's told by some signal. And so there's a model of even semiconductors that we can at least have an analogy to. And we can't do that with quantum. There's not really even a model. And it has to do with the fact that quantum bits can store data in parallel, in superposition. So reality is sort of confused. You can have both zero and one at the same time. And there really is no analogy to that in everyday life.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, there's a sort of oversimplified description of quantum computing that says it's like Schrodinger's cat. The bit exists in multiple states at the same time, and therefore you can process multiple kinds of data at the same time. It's not that simple, but there's a grain of truth to that. And in a quantum computer, to enable it to calculate, you have to maintain those states and stop it decomposing into a regular state. You have to keep it in that state of quantum superposition, which is why when I was first hearing about quantum computers, like 15 years ago, I was first writing. I think I wrote my first article on quantum computers. And at that stage, the quantum bits had to be kept close to absolute zero to prevent any sort of outside world interference hitting the particles there and sort of jolting them out of superposition. So, I mean, it no longer has to always be at absolute zero, does it?
Oh, it depends on the platform. That's true. But, you know, you make the right point, and that is quantum bits need to be isolated. That's the key concept.
Yes.
For them to work right. The analogy to Schrodinger's cat is just great. If only everybody understood what Schrodinger's cat is and had one in their room, in their house. But nobody has that. So there's still no analogy. Well, maybe in the future it'll be in our intuition, having that as part of our vernacular that there's a Schrodinger cat. But indeed, you get to the main point here, and that is the hardware is needed for quantum computers have to have some form of isolation. If your qubits are made out of solid state materials, sort of like the usual semiconductor transistors we have, you have to do a lot of things. One of them is indeed you have to cool the system to nearly absolute zero so that you isolate the system from all the thermal fluctuations in the background. Now, at IonQ, we don't have to do that. And the reason is our individual atoms are the qubits. These are isolated atoms. They're floating in space. On top of a bunch of electrodes. We do have a chip that's just electrodes. There's nothing quantum about that chip. The atoms float above the chip, and the chip itself can be at room temperature because they're not part of the qubit. They're far away. The qubit's isolated. What gives us this isolation is the fact there's no air. We have the chip is in a vacuum chamber. So that's the isolation. That's how we get the isolation in IonQ's quantum computers. But we don't have to go cold.
Right. And intuitively, if you try to make a qubit out of a large enough lump of material to be observable, like the early quantum, like other quantum computer technologies, then you have to worry about the thermal interference. Whereas your qubits are at the atomic level, and the atomic level is where quantum behavior operates unchecked. So it's easy, you've got a quantum level amount, your qubits are at a smaller level, so it's easier to get a quantum effect to remain stable.
Yeah, we call them natural qubits because individual atoms or individual electrons, single photons, for instance, they're naturally quantum. They're simple fundamental particles. This also allows you to scale. Because every, I'll just pick a random example. Every single ytterbium atom of isotope 171 in the universe is exactly the same. So we don't have a yield problem. We don't have to fabricate the atom. We have to get it in we call these things ion traps, these electrodes. We have to get the atom up there. But the qubits themselves are by design absolutely identical. So there's no fabrication yield issue. And therefore we can scale at will without worrying about yield. That's one of the biggest advantages of natural qubits.
Right. Yes. You trade off. There are other things that you have to do, which maybe the other approaches don't have. So, tell us about the state of the quantum computing market, the way the different technologies are sort of maneuvering. I mean, superconducting qubits have been sort of more established. There are possibly more of them, available online on services like Amazon Braket. And, there are actual superconducting quantum computers that have been sold into some more advanced customers. How are the different technologies sort of maneuvering around each other in the market?
Yeah, I would say that the superconductor technology and the ion trap technology are really the only two right now that are being built into systems. Mm-hmm. They're being put on commoditized cloud servers. They're being installed in facilities and so forth. And they're clearly very different physical systems. And so you ask, where is the field? Where's the state of the art in these platforms? Well, we're all at a high level, trying to make obviously bigger and more powerful systems. That means more qubits. But as important, when you make more qubits, you're going to have to do more things with them. You have to wire them together. When you have 100 things and you have to wire every pair, that's 5,000 wires. You have to wire every qubit to every other qubit when you run a program. So the more qubits you have, they have to be higher quality qubits. And that's a tricky scaling conundrum. When you make something bigger, you just said it, when you make a quantum system too big, it becomes susceptible to thermal noise. I like to think of it sometimes, when you make a quantum system too big, it becomes self-aware. So then it sort of it sort of decides on its own what it wants to do. So where the field is on technology, of course, we're making systems bigger, and there are big challenges there. I think on the superconductor and solid state side, the challenges are really fundamental physics. When you make a big solid state system, how do you, all the qubits are a little different. There's a lot of bookkeeping to deal with there. How do you get a better surface? They're plagued by noise. In the ion trap community, our challenge is more of engineering. The fundamental physics of the atom is finished. We're not worrying that, like I said, the atoms are not identical or they have noise. The isolated atoms, they have no decoherence intrinsically. When they idle, they're perfect. They're atomic clocks. But our challenge is really, I didn't say how we wire them together, not with real wires, with laser beams. So we have a lot of optical challenges, optical engineering challenges ahead of us. And like I said, everything's in a vacuum chamber. That's not such a big deal. It's a small thing. So that's on the hardware side. But all of these camps are also working with those who have applications in mind. And what we're learning at IonQ is these early applications, it's not like you're running Windows on your laptop. We're at a very early stage where those that are running applications, they have to dig deep into their quantum computer. They have to understand the fundamental physics and the fundamental wiring issues, and that will help them compile their programs and run more efficiently. So it's called a stack. A full stack quantum computer requires interactions at every level. Whereas, I have my laptop here, it's running Windows. I don't really care what operating system or what browser I'm using. We're not there yet with quantum. When we get there, watch out. It's going to be really fun. That's when we'll be invading data centers with quantum computer racks and so forth. But right now it's about really matching applications and algorithms to the hardware itself.
Yeah. We need to talk at some point about the invasion of the quantum computers and how they're going to, what happens when they arrive in data centers. But first of all, how much of the stack you mentioned, how much of that does IonQ do, and how much is it sensible for any one company to do of the stack? Should you be collaborating up and down the stack, or should you be building it all yourself?
Good question. We at IonQ, we are working at every level of the stack, but we're trying to outsource as much as we can, for sure. And this is where some of our customers come to bear. At the highest level of the stack, we have a company like Hyundai, for instance, an auto company, and they actually want to do two things. They want to model new battery materials for electrical vehicles, but they also want to do pattern recognition for autonomous driving. And there are some hints on how quantum computers can help both of those. So they have applications teams that work very closely with us. So they can give us the application, and we can sort of make baby versions of it on smaller quantum computers. And as we scale our system, we can eventually create value for them. But apart from the highest level applications area, we have to be involved with every level of the stack. It's absolutely required. A company that's not involved at every level of the stack, it's in danger of falling behind, because like I said, there has to be that integration. It's not a commodity yet. You can't just have isolated quantum computer software right now.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yes, that's a good point. A kind of opposing idea I heard at conference recently is that the full stack quantum computing companies are a little bit of a zero interest rate phenomenon, in that while there's lots of VC money around and it makes sense to bet it on big long-term gambles, and a full stack quantum computer is that. Whereas, you know, if you're having to pay interest on the money you're lending to a yeah. to a startup, you might want to pick one that's picking off a smaller part of the problem and has maybe a bigger chance of succeeding.
Well, I might argue the other way, that if you're only picking a small part, it might be that the field mm-hmm. moves towards something that's not compatible with your small part.
Right.
We're not there yet. When you have commoditized quantum computers, then you'll have competing softwares, and that's going to be amazing. That's going to be great.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and, you know, the idea of competing qubits as well. I mean, say if trapped ion qubits turn out to be so much better than superconducting ones that superconducting ones kind of fall back into a kind of niche in a sort of VHS Betamax kind of fashion. Right. Everyone who's bet on superconducting, and there's been a mass bet on it in the last two decades, you know, they'll lose out.
Well, they'll have a workforce that knows about quantum gates. They know some level of the stack, and I think it'll be some level of that work will be transferable.
Masses of it will be transferable, that's for sure. And indeed, you know, you might be overtaken, for instance, by photonic qubits, because you know they have difficulties in that their geometry is very long and thin because you can't bend light much. But a plus in that when you start wanting to network those computers, quantum computers, and distribute entanglements, the qubit's already in the right medium. The photon is the
that's right. I mean, I would say INQ wouldn't be a company without the vision for networking our quantum computers with optics. That was you know, Jungsang Kim and I, when we founded the company, we had this sort of recipe for scale that involved networking separate quantum computers. And this is where it looks like a data center. Actually, no, forget the classical computers in a data center, a whole quantum computer where you have a bunch of racks that are connected by a big optical switch. And Jungsang himself, the co-founder of INQ, he at Bell Labs and back in the day built the largest optical switch ever on record. They didn't need it for classical communication in the end, but that technology exists. And so we're starting, we're in very recently at INQ, sort of starting to do exactly that, building systems that are connected by photons. And what allows that to happen is atoms naturally couple to light. And so atoms are they're the transistor, the memory, and we sort of have the best of both worlds. We can also communicate over distance with light. Atoms don't communicate themselves very well. You know, you'd have to have a big vacuum chamber, atoms moving through space. Instead of doing that, we think of piping their information through photons, through optical fiber. So indeed.
Okay, you are sounding massively confident about this. I'm beginning to believe you've actually got this quantum computer in a semi truck ready to ship to my data center.
my confidence comes mainly because we're not relying on any breakthroughs in physics. Our architecture is really 30 years old. The basic physics was nailed in the 1990s and early 2000s. And it takes many years to go from basic physics to go through the to even have a good engineering plan. The physics really has to be sound. Mm-hmm. And then you have to go from engineering to production. And we're just starting to do that at INQ. Mm-hmm. It's not yet ready to go on a truck, but it will be before too long.
Yeah, so, I mean, tell us how it'll be when these arrive in data centers. I mean, how many racks will you have to clear to install one of these? What sort of cooling and other infrastructure will it need? Yeah. Obviously, that'll depend a bit on which technology you go for.
Yeah, almost the end. I mean, in the ion trap technology, the entirety of the footprint and how many racks it will take for one unit will be dominated by the optics, the optical control. The atoms themselves actually only occupy a few millimeters of space. They're tiny. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can fit thousands, even hundreds of thousands of atoms on in a space that's really tiny, but we have to control them with laser beams. Now, we don't need one laser for each qubit. we can have one laser per, I don't know, 1,000 qubits or something, 100 qubits or something like that. So it's the lasers need cooling. The electronics that run the lasers need cooling. Everything, almost everything, is classical. It's all engineering, mm-hmm. except those atoms. They're the mm-hmm. only thing that's quantum. So that's sort of where the confidence comes from. I mean, this engineering has never been done before of this type, integrating optical sources and conduits on a chip, for instance, and getting all the lasers to be small in size. We're working on that now. But you asked about the footprint. I think our systems will, right now they're the size of a table, but we have plans, definite plans to shrink them down much smaller, eventually integrating on a chip. So right now, we're talking about a rack or two, a couple of racks that could be, it would be looking like what you have in a data center already, maybe a couple of stalls on a data center for a single unit. Mm-hmm. But once we network them, then, then we're off to the races, and it's just a question of how big is your data center.
Right. And in that couple of racks scenario, how many qubits are in those?
I would say a few hundred.
A few hundred, which is a large enough set of qubits to start doing something like real work, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. I think we only need... with some luck, I mean, we're not sure exactly how things are going to scale. And what I mean by that is we're going to need to do some kind of error correction, error mitigation. And in that mm-hmm. work, you have to sacrifice qubits to get better qubits. So we might need a few hundred qubits to do something of commercial value. And that would be just a couple of racks.
That's right. Because there are different measures of the numbers of I'm going to say useful qubits, but there's an actual normal term, isn't there?
We've adopted a term called algorithmic qubits, which sort of counts the number of qubits, but also takes into consideration how good the qubits are, how far you can mm-hmm. go with them. It's sort of the number of usable qubits. Mm. And when we get algorithmic qubits above about 60 or 70, that's when even large high-performance computers, supercomputers, fail to keep up. And that's where we're going to start to see applications come out of the woodwork.
Right. Because, yes, I mean, in the early days of this, there were real questions about whether the speed and power of the actual eventual quantum computer could be would ever be something that couldn't be done quicker by a simulation on a conventional computer. But
yeah, that's right.
That's no longer the case.
Yeah, everybody knows that conventional computers will run out of steam. They just have a different scaling law. Every time you add a qubit, you've in a sense doubled the power of the system. And we don't get that kind of scaling unfortunately, using classical laws of physics.
Right. So you talk about the need for cooling and things like that. I guess cooling a laser is different from cooling a rack of semiconductors, but it's not as extreme as achieving superconductivity.
Yeah, we're talking a few hundred watts of cooling or something. That's really nothing. For a full rack, cooling a few hundred watts, just picking out a number. It's definitely not, tens of hundreds of kilowatts that you're cooling. So it's not like a typical data center.
So actually, it'll be a big relief to data center operators. This stuff will come in and it'll reduce the amount of cooling they need to do.
Yeah, I was surprised. I guess it sort of makes sense that people that run data centers, they think about water. They want to be nearby a water, a cooling plant. Quantum computers, by their nature, don't have to demand so much cooling.
Right. And by the same argument, then not so much power, since all that.
That's right.
I'm not sure why I should find that surprising, that quantum computers require less electrical power than,
At a fundamental level, it shouldn't be surprising because quantum logic is reversible. that means it doesn't have to dissipate anything. The entirety of the power dissipation is all in the classical controls and the classical computers you have that are, in our case, that are guiding laser beams and so forth and running the lasers. That's almost all the power. There's almost no power to run the atoms and to suspend them. That's very, very efficient.
All right. Yeah. Thermal equilibrium, no energy required.
It's the same in superconductors too, right? When you have a superconducting system, the current flows without loss. So there's no dissipation there, but just to get them cold, to get to the superconducting situation does require a lot of power.
I remember hearing about reversible computing with normal room temperature semiconductors. You can operate those in a reversible manner and get infinite amounts of computing for no power. The trouble is it happens infinitely slowly.
Yeah.
Because it has to be in thermal equilibrium at every moment.
Yeah, that's right. There's interesting physics there. People were thinking about this 40 years ago. You know, how do we get reversible computing to work? It was kind of an academic exercise. And Richard Feynman, in the back of the room at this conference, he said, oh, I know a way to do it. Use quantum mechanics, because quantum mechanics is reversible. So that argument you're bringing up actually underlied the birth of quantum computing 40 years ago. It's kind of
that's
fun
right.
Fact.
It was a concept from Feynman originally, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So how soon is it going to happen? Do we need to start clearing rack space for it yet?
Well, there you're going to get a variety of answers, and those the answers will depend on the technology that the person is most familiar with. In the case of IonQ technology, we've broken through an algorithmic qubit number of 29, which sounds like a small number, but again, we're actually well ahead of target on that, our roadmap. And we're predicting a roadmap to go through 64 algorithmic qubits in a couple of years. So it's not a 10 plus year thing here. We really believe it's much sooner than that. And the applications that will help pave the way beyond that will largely be in machine learning and using these systems to make better decisions, to do things like pattern recognition that are more powerful than what you can do classically. And it's really hard to predict, obviously, exactly what sector of the economy that's going to hit, but that's likely going to happen. But in our technology, it's going to be a few years away, not a decade plus.
Right. And as you say, it won't all be exotic applications. You know, you mentioned Hyundai, the car maker, earlier, and the idea of using quantum computing to make better batteries for their vehicles. That's pretty, on most levels, that sounds quite prosaic. I was actually at a quantum computing conference the other day where the second session of the day was on the application of quantum computing to FMCG. And I thought, what the hell is FMCG? I had to look it up. fast moving consumer goods.
Oh my.
The idea that quantum computing is going to help you build a better handbag.
It's incredible. I mean, we're actually, I say it's incredible. We're working with Airbus, and they have a logistics problem of how to sort out where they put their cargo on their planes. You know, this is a highly constrained optimization problem because cargo comes in many different forms, many different volumes, and you have to distribute the weight right. You want the center mass to be somewhere, but you want to fit it all together. I mean, same with Amazon and trucks, but, we're sort of on the hook to work with Airbus to help come up with an optimization algorithm to do that. That does sound rather narrow, but it's very important. I mean, these applications, like I say, they come out of the woodwork. They're everywhere.
And that's squarely in the kind of applications that quantum computers have been put forward for right from the start, that kind of optimization.
Yeah.
I have to admit, that sounds way more convincing than the fast-moving consumer goods presentation I heard. That was, they didn't have a lot to say in that one.
But they have an acronym already, so it must be serious.
Okay, so we're not going to get to a massively concrete answer because this thing is still coming into focus. But it sounds to me like the message I should take away is that at some point, a lot of data centers will have to have some kind of quantum computer in them. And not to panic, because the kind of infrastructure that you've already got in that data center should be able to support the quantum computer when it arrives.
Indeed. One thing we didn't talk about is that these applications, like the Airbus one, like some kind of optimization problem, or even a material science or chemistry simulation, it's going to require a lot of classical computing, GPUs, real data centers. And so it's going to make sense to actually integrate the quantum computers with a conventional data center, because you need to run these quantum computers multiple times and optimize parameters that go into the quantum computer. And that classical optimization can happen in the regular computer, but it's going to need to be kind of integrated in a hybrid format. So it's natural that quantum computers will need to be, not only is it interesting to think about putting them in data centers, they're going to need to be near data centers for their applications.
Ah, absolutely. And so they aren't going to be like edge quantum computers that have to be close to people. They'll be close to computing resources to assist, enable, and interpret what they're doing.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Okay. And I think that's been a really that's a good place to leave it. Quantum computers are coming, and relax, you're ready for them already.
Very good. Yeah.
Very good. Well, Chris, thank you very much for talking to us. It's been a real pleasure.
Okay, Peter, the pleasure's mine. I appreciate the time.
Sustainability is no longer a nice to have. It's a priority. Vertiv Power, cooling and IT management solutions for critical infrastructure, are designed to reduce the use of energy, water, and space. From innovative liquid cooling to dynamic grid services, we work hand-in-hand with customers to enable them to meet their data center sustainability goals. Visit us at vertiv.com and see what we can do for you.
Thanks for listening to the Zero Downtime Podcast. Brought to you in partnership with Vertiv, the world's leading critical digital infrastructure provider. Don't forget to like this podcast and subscribe to our channel. We'll see you again next time.